From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m., we're bringing you interviews, in-depth stories, and entertainment events connected to Black communities in Central Illinois. We start with a focus on literacy. Students who don't read well by the third grade are more likely to drop out or take longer to graduate, according to the education-focused Annie E. Casey Foundation. And there are a lot of kids who are struggling in Illinois. It's why parents and teachers push the state to create a new literacy plan that says schools should spend more time teaching letter sounds or phonics over other reading methods. IPM education reporter Emily Hayes has more.
Raid.
Raid.
Add butt to the beginning.
Raid.
Ride.
Ride.
Add foot to the beginning.
Ride.
Raidle.
Raidle. You can tell by her enthusiasm that teacher Kelly Alikhan used to be a cheerleader. Today she's teaching second graders, including Calvin Cohen at Mead Park Elementary in Danville, how to sound out words.
The super... Swatter?
Swatter, yep.
Starts. Why?
Started swatting.
Yep. And usually each week we just have a new sound of the week to work on. So we practice it and then Fridays we test on it.
This is called phonics, and she's doing what research says is the best way to teach young children how to read.
Reading is a newer advent in human history.
That's Erica Tiemann. She's the Director of Standards and Instruction for the Illinois State Board of Education. She says most kids need explicit instruction, including what sounds letters make, or phonics.
And so our brain is not naturally hardwired to know how to read.
In 2001, Congress commissioned a study that found systematically teaching kids to sound out words works better than using the whole language strategy. That's where students focus more on guessing words based on story context. But whole language theory has been very influential, and Tanaya York says not enough kids are learning phonics. She's a former principal and a literacy consultant.
You can't have classrooms where students doing a lot of independent reading in time but haven't really learned how to read.
In fact, 38% of Illinois students didn't have basic reading skills by the fourth grade in 2022, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. That's just above the national average. Black and Hispanic children are even less likely to be proficient than white children.
And we have not been serving our Black children well. We need to interrogate why. And if they are not learning how to read, then we need to be looking at what structures we need to put in place.
It's the reason York joined the Illinois Early Literacy Coalition. This group of parents and educators got a law passed last year. It required the State Board of Education to create a literacy plan, which was adopted on January 24th. Erica Tiemann helped write the plan. While phonics plays a key role, it isn't the only thing in it.
It is a foundational skill. It's not the entire focus of the plan, but it's definitely an important piece of literacy, evidence-based literacy instruction.
Mead Park principal Tanner D. Lawyer wishes he learned more about phonics when he was first training to become a middle school teacher.
I also wish I had more of a primary mindset teaching fifth grade, because I think it would have made me a better teacher.
But the new plan is just a guide for school districts. They don't have to do anything different under the law, and that's a concern for York.
It's like we're inviting people to try to do the right thing. Like, that's kind of how it's written. That makes me say it may not have the impact that we would want it to really have.
Tiemann says mandating changes would be difficult because so many administrators and teachers would have to learn so much in a short period of time. And she says mandates are not always effective.
Generally, if you can get people to critically reflect on their practices and really identify, you know, we may need to consider changes to this and get them to arrive at those conclusions on their own, the adoption of that work that needs to be done and the ownership of that work is going to be on them.
In between classes, Mead Park principal Tanner D. Lawyer says phonics has already been a focus in Danville Public Schools since the district adopted a new reading curriculum a few years ago, so very little will change.
And really just getting every staff member trained with that and being on the same page so we have a common language across the board. And students, you know, even though mobility is high across the district and in Mead Park, students will have the same instruction throughout.
Despite high poverty rates, the school is doing well, according to the state report card. Black students improved faster in reading last year than their peers at almost any other school in East Central Illinois. The state has to prepare training courses for teachers and administrators on the lessons in the literacy plan by January 2025. I'm Emily Hayes.
It's time. It's time. It's time.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. Nearly 3.5 years ago, Evanston in the Chicago suburbs made national headlines when its city council approved what it called a reparations program. The idea, revenue from the city's tax on marijuana, would go to a small number of its residents to the tune of $25,000 each, which they could use for mortgage payments, home down payments, or home repairs. Today on Dialogue, we are hearing what the Evanston Reparations Initiative has meant for the city and if it's possible to recreate elsewhere, like Champaign-Urbana. Recently, Brian Mackey, host of our weekday talk show, The 21st, on AM 580, dived into this topic. First, let's hear excerpts of his interview with former alderman Robin Rue Simmons, who led the efforts for reparations in Evanston.
So we are making progress. It's a new standard of legislating for the Black community, one that has inspired a national movement to organize for local reparations. But we're excited about the future. We are building on our progress. In 2019, we had only a resolution. Today, we have a fund, we have policy that has been programmed, and most importantly, we have been disbursing reparations. Taking that first step in Evanston has been important. We can measure wealth being created by $25,000 on direct benefits.
70% of the white respondents said the Evanston reparations program is good public policy. That diverges pretty significantly from other surveys we've seen. There was a Pew report last year that found significantly lower support for reparations among white Americans, less than 20%. Now, I realize it's not exactly apples to apples because that was reparations for slavery, not redlining, but I wonder why you think there's such a vast difference in those numbers.
Well, the difference is because we are in practice. We've gone through extensive public education as a community and even as a city council. In 2019, Professor Al Tillery actually did a closed session training with the city council on racial discrimination, anti-Blackness in our city, and even more broadly, touching on the discrimination in the rollout of the GI Bill as an example. And so we were fully educated on the history of reparations, understanding that it is not novel. There's been many attempts at repair. And we learned about the legal frameworks for repair, the international approach to reparations, full repair or comprehensive reparations, five components. So together as a community, our white community included, learned about implicit bias and how unknowingly the white community might sustain these racial gaps through various actions. And so we spent time learning together, healing together. And once we implemented reparations, we heard from recipients. We heard from recipients that spoke to how they feel more trust for their government, how they feel more hope for the circumstances of their future generations of their families, how they have first felt seen and heard and appreciated and included in their community because of reparations. And then it supports our values. And Evanston on the city council at that time, we valued racial equity as a high priority. We had near 100 resolutions and proclamations in the names of Black lives and Black history. And it helped us reach our goals and values as a city. I believe that's why we are seeing the support from the white community. We have proven that it's not going to create a race riot, that it is not going to bankrupt our city, that there are ways to fund reparations. You mentioned cannabis sales tax as our initial funding mechanism, we have included an additional $10 million from graduated real estate transfer taxes as well. And in addition to that, we have a reparations fund at the city and an additional one that is primarily funded by our interfaith community, synagogues, temples, churches, and led by a Black-led organization, the Reparations Stakeholder Authority of Evanston. And so our ally community funded an additional $1 million in a pretty short period of time to be a partner to the municipal effort for reparations and be a partner that could sustain reparations beyond any type of political effort that we're seeing at the city.
Fewer Black respondents than white respondents said they supported the program. What do you make of that?
Well, reparations is complicated. And if you ask five different Black community members nationwide, what forms of reparations they would like, you might get five different answers. And so I think that leading with housing may have given folks some pause if their priority was something else. One thing that we try to remind everyone is that this isn't a settlement. We're not done. This is a first step. Our legislation includes three other areas of repair, which we are working towards. And in addition to that, we hadn't yet added cash benefits as an option for receiving reparations benefits. So I do believe that now that we have dispersed reparations, more community members see that it's real, see that it is attainable, that their families are benefiting, that their neighbors are receiving redress, that the checks are being cut. And I do believe that if we were to go out for survey, that we would see that number increase as the community gains more trust in the program and the benefits being dispersed.
Robin Rue Simmons, so you're leading this group now that works with, aims to work with other communities that want to pursue that. I wonder if there are any, where you're hearing from in Illinois, around the country, any places that surprised you maybe?
No surprises. I would say that we have the most of the activity is in the Midwest, and there is great activity happening on the West Coast. I'm sure you've heard of the California Task Force and their 1,100-page report with recommendations and proposals for reparations. San Francisco is doing some incredible work with very ambitious commitment for reparations in the form of cash payments, as well as dozens of other types of reparations. So we're seeing activity all across the nation in every region. At First Repair, we actually have a monthly strategy session that has grown so that we now have to have regional monthly breakout sessions. And so there's activity happening in Miami-Dade County, in South Fulton County, Georgia. New York State is next up as a state to introduce, or has already introduced, our own state. Illinois has a reparations task force, which is being appointed by the governor, already has a chair, Marvin Slaughter, in fact. And so we're seeing activity all across the nation in municipalities, counties, and even at a state level. We're also seeing quite a bit of activity within institutions, in church or houses of worship and denominations, as well as the academy is doing more. Harvard made a $100 million initial commitment for reparations, and there are others that are following in suit of Harvard as an academy that is committed to reparations.
What will you see as success 10, 20 years down the line?
Our North Star as localities is that there is a federal bill for reparations. H.R. 40 was introduced in 1989. It's languished in Congress since. It did pass judiciary a couple of years ago, but we are hopeful for a federal response because it will take that. Localities, even all of us together, we simply don't have the capacity to address the harm worthy of reparations, but we are doing our part and we won't let that stop us.
Mm-hmm.
That was Brian Mackey of the 21st Show talking with former Alderman Robin Rue Simmons, who led the efforts for reparations in Evanston. There are also discussions about a reparations program here in Central Illinois.
So if we could kind of change the paradigm to think that reparations is just an extra, an add-on to more of an essential element, not just for African Americans, but for the entire community.
We'll have a dialogue about that next. Also, following two fatal police shootings last year, the Rantoul Police Department still hasn't implemented any department-wide trainings. And later, a music professor from Illinois State helps us walk with the ancestors. Plus, a tribute to a Black classical music host here in Champaign, Urbana. You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. For Illinois Soul, I'm Reginald Hardwick. Let's bring you up to speed about some events around town. Thursday, February 22nd at 5 p.m., listen to the R&B and soul sounds from Champaign-Urbana's Hockey and Them. It's part of the Uncorked series of concerts at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Also, Thursday at 6 p.m., you can learn about Black health, wealth, and wellness at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Local Black leaders will discuss empowerment in the main conference room. And on Saturday, February 24th, come to the Champaign Public Library for the Battle of the Books. Students in grades 3 to 5 will be tested on their knowledge of books and Black history. All of these events are listed on our website, illinoisoul.org. From Illinois Soul, you're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the Black communities of Central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Evanston in the Chicago suburbs made national headlines when its city council approved a reparations program in 2019. Since then, some Black residents have received $25,000 to use on their homes or for mortgage payments. The money comes from revenue from the city's tax on cannabis. Here's reaction from some residents captured on the PBS NewsHour last year.
I just figured the country would not approve nothing like that.
Lou Weathers wasn't just surprised.
Yeah. I was shocked.
Shocked?
Yeah.
Weathers used his $25,000 to reduce his son's mortgage here in Evanston.
Well, anytime you reduce your mortgage payment is going to be lower. His bill's going to be lower. He can use the money for other things.
I had said it from the beginning that we were not going to see this money at all.
But hairdresser Donna Walker was wrong.
Some people did see it, and I'm very happy that they did. And I'm happy that the elders are able to, you know, pay taxes on their home, fix it up.
Walker's next-door neighbor, fellow hairdresser Gigi Giles, is on the waiting list for funds that will come in future years.
So you figure you will get it eventually?
Eventually, if not, my grandchildren or my daughters will get it.
What will you do with the money?
I will fix up my home. I would do my kitchen and my two bathrooms.
Can you do that for 25 grand?
I'd make it work.
In our last segment, we heard from the alderman who pushed for the program in Evanston. Our weekday talk program, The 21st Show, also recently spoke with Dr. Jeff Trask. He is the chair of the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition and an adjunct professor in the College of Applied Health Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll pick up their conversation with some of the harms to African Americans in Champaign-Urbana's history.
In Champaign County, between 1941 and 1950, we had 774 parcels of land, 65 Rantoul, 50 near Savoy, and the rest in Champaign-Urbana, that had specific language in it, and I'll just read it just to be word for word here. No part thereof will be sold or leased, either in whole or in part, to or permitted to be occupied as owner or tenant by any person or persons not of the Caucasian race. These type of covenants that they have for parcels of land led to, you know, what we all commonly know as redlining and only allowing Black people to live in certain areas. And so that's just one example of some of the things that have happened in Champaign County. One other quick example I'll share is that in 1951, Champaign built 70 public housing units for whites and 70 public housing units for Blacks. The housing units for whites, the two projects in total received the $1.4 million, but only 21% of that money went towards the housing project for Blacks.
You know, when you talk about Champaign County, you can't talk about it without mentioning the university. And Abby in Urbana sent us a text message pointing that out. She said, "I think it's long overdue. It doesn't shock me that a community like Evanston embraced and delivered this. I think saying and demonstrating, look, we wrong people, we need to try to make this right, goes a long way, more than just talk." And she went on to say, "The Champaign-Urbana area has its own history, tangled in the university's history. You can't tell CU history without acknowledging the barriers the university created. If Evanston can provide a basic model of a reparation program, perhaps other communities can adapt it to fit their needs and resources. It's a conversation worth having." Jeff, what do you have to say to Abby's message?
Well, there's definitely some truth to that. If you look at the historical record, the university housing refused to house Black students until about 1945. And then we also have the kind of the infamous Project 500 history, where the University of Illinois did a good thing in recruiting a number of African-American students to Champaign-Urbana, about 565 students. They failed to provide adequate housing for them, and some were left without any housing at all. And then, of course, we had the incident in January 1968 where those students protested this fact, and 240-something got arrested for that protest due to some minor damage by 10 of the students to some furniture in the union, but 240-something students got arrested for that incident because they're all basically saying we need some place to live. And there was issues of, in terms of not many places in town were allowing Black students to live in different apartments and so on and so forth. And so, again, there's this history there, and we know there's lots of things to kind of make up for. So I think she's absolutely right.
What do you hear from people in Black communities in Champaign-Urbana, right? I mean, part of me wondered if it's like a distrust of government to fix the problem. What are you hearing out there?
Well, I think for a long time, a lot of people didn't think reparations was even a possibility, the same way we didn't think that we could have a Black president at one point in time. But then all of a sudden, President Obama won Iowa, and all of a sudden the eyebrows perked up and people started thinking, oh, wait a minute, this could actually take place. And I think to some degree, we're in the same kind of place with reparations, that for a long time, we didn't think it was any way possible this was going to happen. But now when we see what Evanston has done, we know, wait a minute, this is possible. And so I think it's going to take a little time for that to kind of sink in for even the, you know, population of African Americans, but I think it'll grow, and people will start seeing, you know, not only see that it's possible, but get involved and help make it happen.
What motivated you to get involved in the idea of pursuing reparations in Champaign-Urbana?
There's a number of things that got me involved with this. Our church, New Covenant Fellowship, started a reparations committee within the church itself, and they asked me to chair that because they signed an anti-racism pledge as a faith community, as a church, and wanted to actually put some action behind that pledge. And so part of that action was to develop a reparations committee within the church. We've since then have had monthly educational opportunities to learn more about various historical and present conditions of African Americans. We've had webinars, we've had film screenings, we use Sunday mornings to educate people. And then out of that group was an outgrowth of our community group, where we just kind of advertised. You mentioned the News Gazette article. We got the word out, and there's a group of community folks, both faith-based, non-faith-based, all kind of people involved that see this as an important issue as well, and therefore are striving towards that. I'm looking at a map of Champaign-Urbana that has a population marked by colors, and you can see pretty distinctively that there are certain spots in our community where African Americans are concentrated. And when you look at those areas, you can also know that statistically, there's a lot of areas of disparities in those areas as well, in terms of health care and renting versus owning homes and businesses and banking versus predatory lenders and food deserts, you know. And so you can see the current ramifications of some of these issues in Champaign-Urbana pretty distinctively and statistically. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I want to get involved with this. And when you do your own homework and research, you come to the conclusion that the most that can be done is the least that can be done when it comes to reparations.
We did hear from some members of our texting group who were not enthusiastic about this. Christopher in Brimfield said, "I know injustice has been going on for a long time, but reparations would open up a Pandora's box, and where would it stop?" We also heard from Franny in Hinckley, who said, "I think reparations is a rather silly idea when we still live in a very racist society. Let's focus on making right now a kinder, gentler place to live." And Jeff, I wonder if you want to respond to what they had to say.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I'll just respond briefly. One of the things that I contend when it comes to prioritizing something like reparations is that when we get our bills from our homes and we look at our electric bill and our water bill, unless you're financially strapped, you usually look at those two bills and you don't plan on just paying one of them. You plan on paying both. And if we can change the paradigm about what reparations is, it's not an add-on, but it should be a very integral part of our structure to actually promote the type of society that one of the callers said we should have, because I do believe that making a group of people whole after being oppressed for so long will create those communities that she's speaking of. And so if we could kind of change the paradigm to think that reparations is just an add-on to more of an essential element, not just for African Americans, but for the entire community. We all benefit when we build our communities up like that.
What will be your barometer in 10 years, 20 years, to see how successful these efforts have been?
Sure. Thank you for this time to share. I would say that there would not really be an end point. It'll be a part of our life on an ongoing basis, like a journey versus a destination. And it'll be something where we're constantly looking at ways of how do we repair the damage that was done in so many different areas, for Black people over the years. And that it'll just be an ongoing process, and that our policies, our resources, our time and energy will all kind of incorporate what does it mean to be equitable, what it means to repair the damage that was done on an ongoing basis. Because trust me, there is so much work to do. 5, 10, 20 years, we'd be scratching the surface to moving this along. So I think it's a journey versus a destination.
You've been listening to Dr. Jeff Trask, chair of the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition, speak with Brian Mackey, host of our weekday talk program, The 21st Show, which airs at 11 a.m. on AM 580. Tell us what you think about reparations by giving us a call at 217-244-1989. Again, 217-244-1989. Or email us at illinois-soul@illinois.edu. You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. Two people died at the hands of police in Rantoul last year. Officials say these were the city's first ever fatal police shootings. Now, local activists are concerned about the police department's lack of action to prevent future officer-involved shootings. Farah Anderson reports for IPM News and the Invisible Institute. And a note to listeners, this story contains descriptions of violence.
In February of last year, 21-year-old Rantoul resident Azan Lee was stopped by a group of officers. Lee was suspected of stealing a car. Body cam footage shows the officers approached Lee as he was walking down the street. They began to search him. Rantoul police officer Jose Aceves told Lee to pull out the contents of his pockets, which included loose change and a lighter. Then Aceves reached into the pocket of Lee's hoodie and found a gun. Lee started to run. Officer Aceves followed and kept his hands on Lee.
Get on the ground now.
Get on the ground or you're going to get shot! Get on the
ground. In the struggle, Officer Aceves shot Lee with Lee's own gun. As Lee continued to run, Aceves fired 3 more shots from his weapon. None of them hit Lee. Lee was transported to the hospital where he died. Whenever an officer uses force, the Rantoul Police Department's Use of Force Review Board evaluates whether the officers followed internal policies. In this case, the board, made up entirely of Rantoul police staff, concluded Officer Aceves did nothing wrong. The board recommended Aceves receive additional firearm training, but he resigned just 1 month after the shooting. And just a few months later, he was hired by the Champaign County Sheriff's Department. A department memo shows Rantoul police supervisors told the department Aceves might need close supervision. In June, another Rantoul police officer killed a person, this time during a traffic stop. 18-year-old Jordan Richardson was shot as he ran away with a weapon in hand. In this case, the Use of Force Review Board found the officer, Jerry King, also did not violate the department's policies. The board did not recommend individual follow-up training for him. And just 2 days later, the department sent him to a shooting range. Officials say that's because he needed a new weapon since his last one was seized by the Illinois State Police for its investigation. In both shootings, the board recommended that all Rantoul police staff undergo hands-on training in how to respond to high-stress situations. But documents we obtained through open records requests show the department hasn't implemented any of those recommended trainings.
They're not binding. They are recommendations.
That's Rantoul Deputy Chief Justin Baus.
But they are something that we look at and obviously start to chart a course towards fulfilling, you know, each of those recommendations.
Baus says many of the department's trainings haven't resumed since they were halted by the pandemic, and they always have to consider how much funding they have. Since the fatal shootings, local activists have been pressuring the department to do more.
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
What do we want?
Urbana resident and activist Derek Bryle says he doesn't trust the police's internal investigation.
You're never going to get an honest review when cops are reviewing cops.
Bryles helped deliver a petition with over 700 signatures from Champaign County residents, pushing for independent, third-party investigations into the fatal shootings. Rantoul police officials say there's no need for that, which is disappointing to Bryles.
They have shown absolutely zero willingness to improve, to admit that things could have been handled differently, to really engage with the public in any way or in any meaningful action really at all following either shooting.
Most police department policies allow officers to justify their use of force if they feel their lives are in danger, says Michael Sierra Arevalo. He's a national expert on the use of force in policing and a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Rantoul's policy is no different.
My work would suggest that what you're looking at here is actually just the logical conclusion, the logical outcome of a policing system that is designed to protect the lives of officers over that of citizens.
And even when departments implement training, he says there's no real evidence that they help reduce force.
I think the simple fact is you're not going to train your way out of a lot of these problems.
The best thing police departments can do, he says, is closely examine everything that happened leading up to a fatal shooting, not just determine whether the officer followed protocol. Rantoul Deputy Chief Bao says the board does consider all these things. Sierra Arevalo also says departments should do psychological evaluations for officers and offer mental health services and breaks from patrol after high-stress situations. Deputy Chief Baus would not confirm whether the department did any of these things. Police officials did say in an earlier interview they want to get more officers into the recommended trainings this spring. I'm Farrah Anderson, reporting for IPM News and the Invisible Institute.
Just ahead, find out where you can see a one-woman show where a queen mother of Ghana helps us walk with the ancestors.
Being able to share the story, this experience that most people don't even think about, most people don't even know.
And later, a tribute to a pioneering Black classical music host here in Champaign, Urbana.
I didn't know Black people did classical music. You know, they wrote classical music. What?
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. Welcome back to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We're going to turn it over now to my colleague Kimberly Schofield, who has a profile of an artist bringing her one-woman show to Urbana.
One funny one, nanum, one funny one, janum. As I was here before ya, one funny one, nanum, one funny one, janum. Ye bu one den ye bu one den ye bu one trend, noa. When ye menim ya.
Dr. Ama Ufuriwa Aduonum spent 5 months in African slave dungeons to get a better understanding of her ancestors' experiences. Her time there helped inspire the performance piece Walking with My Ancestors, Cape Coast Castle, coming to Spurlock Museum in Urbana on February 25th. I recently spoke with her about her time in the dungeons and how she uses different elements of music in her teachings and her performances.
Tamale, tamale, to Mabala.
You grew up participating in your family's drumming ensembles. What inspired you to use music in your teachings as well as in your performances to help talk about such big and sometimes really heavy topics?
In Ghana, when we say music, it's not just music. It's more than music. It involves drumming. It involves singing. It involves dancing. It involves theatrical enactment. When I did the research in those former dungeons, the experiences that I had could only be shared through all those elements. It just felt natural to me to just do that because music alone was just not enough. There were parts where I felt that dance will best share what I experienced. There were parts where I felt singing was the best platform or format to share what it is that I experienced in those spaces.
Fatu fai fai fatu fatu kelemandio fatu yo tijajalano.
What prompted you to say, I'm going to go to this place where people were shackled and slaved and experience it?
Here at ISU, I teach a course called Black Music. One time when I was sharing the video, my students asked me, Dr. Eduonum, have you been to this place before? And I said, no, I've not. And this was in 2007. And they said, you should go. I said, oh, you know what? I think I'll do that. And so I applied for a grant and I received the grant and I went off to Goree Island. So that is where my journey started in 2008. I was there for about 6 weeks and then I came back to Ghana, to Elmina Castle in Ghana and also Cape Coast Castle in Ghana. When I showed that video to my students, I wanted them to think about how those spaces could have inspired the formation, the imagination of music for those who were shackled in there. And so when I went through those spaces, I was also thinking what types of music could be found, you know, imagined in these spaces. We're talking about Africans who come from a long tradition of drumming and dancing and all this stuff. And here they were shackled. It was, again, trying to understand this music, the sound, the moaning and the groaning and the falsetto singing and everything else that comes with this music. And I felt as if these spaces could give me a clue as to how the music sound the way they do or how the music were reimagined in these spaces.
You say, as part of the performance piece, you visited the dead to learn from them in Ghana. How has that changed or inspired the way that you have taught or inspired what you have done in Walking with My Ancestors now?
Well, you know, in Ghana, we have several proverbs and several philosophical teachings. And one of them is Sankofa. And Sankofa says or teaches us that we need to go back to our past, learn from our past in order to move forward. When I said the past has something to say and I'll go back home to the dungeons and I visited the spirits of the dead, it's really going back to the past to learn from the past in order to propel to move forward. In my teaching, I'll always go back to the past and make those connections for my students, for them to understand that this music didn't just come from nowhere. It has roots. It has a past. When I'm teaching Black music, I just don't teach Black music in this country or in the diaspora. I'll go back to Africa and talk about the foundations of that music, the sense of community, how the sense of community informs how the music is organized. And then with that foundation, we move on to see, well, how much has changed? Why did this change? How much did the long walk or the long march or the dungeons, how much did those experiences impact the music, the sound, the movement that accompanies this music?
It's a really heavy topic, and then the responses are also very heavy. Do you ever feel like it wasn't worth it, or do you feel defeated by it?
It never defeated me. It always inspires me. It always motivates me. That is what really inspires me in the classroom when I teach and when I perform, being able to share the story, this experience that most people don't even think about. Most people don't even know that there were places such as these where Africans were shackled and kept for months before they were placed on the boats across the Atlantic.
I know it's a topic that I'm sure a lot of people are uncomfortable about and uncomfortable talking about. What do you hope that people take away from it?
If we are uncomfortable, how did they, who went through those spaces, how did they feel? We have to be bold and brave to really face the truth of what happened. I hope that people are going to leave this performance and this showcase inspired, knowing that some people survived. And also to know that the human spirit is a very powerful spirit that can overcome a lot and will fight, will resist in order to survive. But also to tell truth, to be uncomfortable, because therein lies knowledge. When we are uncomfortable, that is when I think we are moved and shifted to rethink what we've accepted as our truths, and we are challenged to think otherwise, to expand our thinking and our knowledge. So I do hope people who experience my work think about those who went through, empathize, and also think deeply about how this history really connects us all. It informs us all. We all experience and have benefited from this history, and it needs to be told and shared.
After the performance, audience members can stay for a talk back for an even deeper conversation about the issues brought up in Walking with My Ancestors, Cape Coast Castle. You can see the performance at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana on Sunday, February 25th at 2 p.m. I'm Kimberly Schofield.
How do you celebrate ancestors in your family? Leave us a voicemail at 217-244-1989. Again, 217-244-1989. We may use your answers on a future dialogue show. You're listening to the music of William Grant Still, a Black composer of nearly 200 works, including 5 symphonies and 9 operas. Classical music by people of color has not always received much attention. Roger Cooper, a longtime classical host at Illinois Public Media, filled the gap with a series of programs celebrating Black performers and composers. IPM News reporter Jim Meadows has more about Classically Black.
Classically Black is produced by Roger Cooper at the studios of WILL-FM Urbana, the broadcasting service.
That's how Roger Cooper opened many of his Classically Black broadcasts, which first aired in the late 1980s and became an annual feature during Black History Month in February. One of the early programs showcased William Warfield. The bass baritone was perhaps best known for singing Old Man River in the 1951 movie version of the musical Showboat. But on Classically Black, Cooper provided a larger selection of his work.
To introduce Mr. Warfield, here is his performance of a work by Heinrich Schütz, Eile mich Gott zu erretten, a very expressive piece from the Baroque era. This is the piece Mr. Warfield chose to open his extraordinary town hall debut.
Eile mich Gott zu erretten, Herr, mir zu helfen.
Roger Cooper fell in love with classical music at an early age while growing up in Evansville, Indiana. But he found little support at home, where his family's conservative religious background discouraged most music outside of church.
I mean, I didn't know Black people did classical music. You know, they wrote classical music. What? You know, my experience of classical music with Blacks was the radio and jazz, the occasional artist that you might hear on a program, but it was always a big rarity.
One of the people who helped Cooper learn about Black contributions to classical music was William Warfield. By the time of his appearance on Classically Black, he was a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. In fact, Cooper had studied under him as a graduate student. In the program showcasing Warfield, Cooper asked about his performance in Leonard Bernstein's unconventional 1956 presentation of Handel's Messiah with the New York Philharmonic.
How did you and Mr. Bernstein arrive at this breakneck speed?
He did. Uh-huh. I showed up for rehearsal at Carnegie. And he started off, boom, 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 boom. I said, I don't do it that fast. He said, oh, but I want, the strings have to rage. I mean, this is about war, and I want to be able to rage with the strings. And so I said, well, okay, let's try it. He said, try it. It'll work. And sure enough, it did. I just, whoop, and off it went.
I know the nation so young.
Warfield also appeared on other classically black programs showcasing Marian Anderson, Paul Robeson, and Warfield's former wife and Porgy and Bess performing partner, Leontine Price.
And he knew everybody. He knew all of the black classical performers who were still living and performing, and some of those who had passed on. And so he could speak of them in first person. I knew him, and this is what they thought, and it was great.
In addition to Warfield, Cooper turned to music historians and other experts for help in telling the stories of black performers and composers. For instance, there was the 1995 program about 20th century black composer William Grant Still. For that program, Cooper interviewed Still's daughter, Judith Ann Still.
Well, he was a gentle, loving man, very much dedicated to his work, so we didn't see him a lot during the day when he was composing. He would emerge in the evening and read bedtime stories.
Cooper traces his connection to Judith Ann Still to an earlier classically black broadcast where he played one of Still's choral works.
And it concluded with an anthem by William Grant Still called All That I Am that got to be very, very popular. His daughter called me to say thank you for playing that and telling me what an impact it had had on the ordering of the music and stuff. And a lot of church choirs were doing it and stuff like that.
Classically Black reached a national audience during the 1990s when it was picked up by American Public Radio, later Public Radio International. Compared to when the program began, Roger Cooper says black performers and composers are better represented in the classical music world today, at least up to a point. He says many still deserve more attention, such as black composers from past eras, among them the black Baroque composer Joseph Bologna, who Cooper showcased in one of the later classically black programs.
Nobody had ever heard of a black Baroque composer or a black classical composer or a black person who was a friend to one of the major composers like George Bridgetower and Beethoven. So I think like everything else, things have improved, but there's still ways to go.
Roger Cooper retired from WYLL-FM in 2008, 2 years after producing his last classically black program, that one showcasing 20th century composer and pianist Florence Beatrice Price. But Classically Black remains on the air. The older programs are rebroadcast every year on WYLL-FM. I'm Jim Meadows, Illinois Public Media.
And a footnote about that story, which originally aired in 2022, it won a National Public Media Award from the National Educational Telecommunications Association. That's it for this week's Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are brought to you by Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.